Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Anthony Wong, ACS President, CERC President, CEO of AGW Consulting, past CIO, and leading top-ranking international lawyer, executive, and authority in business and IT. Anthony, you bring to this interview a substantive history of significant and considerable national and international contributions. We are indeed fortunate to have you come in and share your deep experiences with the audience, and thank you for this.
Thank you, Stephen. Very happy to join you for this interview.
Anthony, you're an extremely busy individual because of all of the history of success that you have, and I know that you're invited to speak at the Second World Chinese Economic Forum because of your globally recognized leadership. So can you tell us more about your talk and what you hope to achieve?
Sure, Steve. And this forum is called the World Chinese Economic Forum, and it will take place in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And one of its objectives is to get different groups of Chinese, what we call the Chinese diaspora, who's migrated from China all over the world, to come to this forum to talk about the emergence of the Chinese economic power in the 21st century. It's a forum to encourage discussions about the role Asia is playing, particularly China, towards the world economy, and how to promote closer business linkages among members of the Chinese diaspora to tap into entrepreneurial resources around the world and providing a platform for global collaboration. So during this forum, I've been invited to speak on the power of innovation and communications, particularly with IT, from the IT's perspective. So just to summarize, my talk will start with doing an analogy to the ancient New Silk Road of 2,000 years ago, which linked China to going west to Middle East and to Europe. So I'll be talking about how technology, in particularly the internet and broadband, how that will create a new virtual Silk Road from China, Asia, and to the rest of the world, including to the old markets of Europe.
Well, that sounds like a remarkable talk and one that will drive a lot of interest. So how does that relate to sort of your work in industry or your work with the Australian Computer Society, and how does that sort of tie into your talk?
As you know, Stephen, my background is technology. I have over 25 years as an ICT professional. I also have background in law, and I practice in the area of information technology and intellectual property law. As you know, with the new emergence of our digital economy, most of the world's assets now are tied up in intellectual property and not in what we call the traditional bricks and mortar assets as such. So basically, I'll be using this dual experience I have in IT and the law, and also my management experience from the many years past, to see how we could tie all these different areas and see how they could help in terms of creating the new Silk Road for transformation, innovation, and connection for the, as we say, the Chinese diaspora spread throughout the world. So rather than a physical Silk Road, this will be a virtual road created by the power of telecommunications and its conversion with devices, computing devices, and the digital media. How the three factors of evolution has now really, really converging with the rapid innovation in those three areas. So I think we've come to a 21st century where the power of those three areas are now giving us the ability to create a virtual Silk Road and also for connections with people around the world, and obviously for business, for business transactions and business activities, linking many, many countries.
Well, I can tell from your experiences and just this breadth of and depth of a background that you have that it'll apply to many kind of different scenarios and different roles. And for example, you recently participated in the innovation study for the ICT Industry Innovation Council. So can you summarize some key lessons from this work?
Early in 2010, I was invited by Australian Minister Carr, who heads the Department of Innovation, Science and Technology, to join the IT Innovation Industry Council. The objectives of the council is to look at innovations, obviously to provide input to our government to create a more sustainable conditions for innovation in Australia so that we can enable port and development of economic, environmental and social priorities through the ICT perspective. Using ICT for change management and business transformation, and also connecting our industry community to build that culture of innovation, working with academia and our research, Australian research facilities. One of the purposes of that council is also to provide networking and collaborative opportunities to support the different activities for innovation transformation in the Australian landscape. So we're working with a number of people from all walks of life, but who works in the ICT industry, from government community, researchers, practitioners, and the community. So to support the idea with the government to power new ideas to create an innovative agenda for Australia into the 21st century. As part of that membership of that council, I also have been invited to undertake an interview conducted by KPMG and the University of Sydney to see what CEOs mean when they say they want to innovate. Different people with different backgrounds have different belief systems and different ideas and meanings of what it means to innovate. So this study is to look at, from people's different perspective and background, how do we create cultures of innovation when there are so many perspectives of the meaning of innovation and the method of achieving innovation.
You know, you were recently interviewed by ABC Radio on the airline's computer system crash. Can you profile what happened and what measures can be taken to prevent this from occurring again?
As you might remember, Stephen, when the World Computer Congress finished on the Thursday, we have the IFIP General Assembly on the Saturday and the Sunday. On the Saturday morning, Virgin Blue, which is a large domestic Korean airline in Australia, their computer system crashed early on the Saturday morning. As a result, more than 50,000 people and more than 100 flights traveling across Australia was cancelled, and 50,000 was people's itineraries and plans were thrown into disarray. What happened was it appeared that there was a hardware crash to the system, and the backups did not come about for about a day. The backups did not gear up to service to replace the systems. So what happens, the manual system has to kick in. As you know, the manual system was not fast enough, and it could not process the number of people in the check-in counters and to get the planes off the ground. So as a result, that was a big illustration of the impact of technology and also the impacts when technologies do not function as they should to assist us in our daily community and business activities. So I highlighted about the dangers of our reliance on technology without proper business continuity plans, without proper business disaster recovery plans, and to make sure that actually come into play when we have issues with our computers. Computers, like everything else, they do fail, and by no way is guaranteed they will work all the time. So there is some safeguards that we need to put in place, especially when we're moving into areas of critical infrastructure, as technology is now used to manage a lot of critical infrastructure, including electricity, power, water, and a number of other life-sustaining and businesses' critical infrastructure.
So do you see a role then having a what we would call something like a professional workforce to kind of support the critical infrastructure to have quality standards and so on?
It definitely does. Because of that reliance on technology, it raises the issue of professional standards, Stephen. Because as the world becomes ever more dependent on ICT, we need to ensure that our systems we use are reliable, secure, and trustworthy. We also need to ensure that the people design, install, and support them are operating at the highest professional standards. And it is for this very reason that the Australian Computer Society has made a significant investment to develop the Australian Computer Society certification program, which will allow members to be recognized as certified professional or certified technologists, with the additional level of certified specialists being introduced in 2011. And the ACS certification is our key element in our campaign to drive professionalism. And for the reasons that I have stated, it is an important initiative, and working with our sister organizations around the world through IP3 and IFIP to build this momentum for a single international standard of professionalism for ICT professionals.
You know, that's fascinating. In fact, we'll go back to a little bit later about IFIP and IP3 and what that means. I have some questions in that area. Now, something that really interesting happened back in September, a few weeks ago, and that is that the Australian Computer Society hosted the 2010 World Computing Congress, and I kind of think of this as like the Olympics of computing because it's held every 2 years. In addition, for the first time, there was an event called IP3 Day. Now, can you summarize some key outcomes from this World Computing Congress and IP3 Day and what this means to some of the stakeholder audiences out there?
Sure, Stephen. To start with the World Computer Congress, I believe there are five key outcomes coming out of the World Computer Congress, the 2010 in Brisbane, which was held in September. I believe the World Computer Congress provided huge public and business community awareness of ICT professionals and their innovation and their achievements. That's one of the key outcomes. Secondly, that Congress is one of the driving forces, I believe, towards a global profession. It also raises ICT issues on the Australian political agenda because we also have quite a number of our politicians who were involved presenting and taking part in debates during the four-day World Computer Congress. And it also provided a world-class forum for ICT practitioners to share their views and knowledge while providing a platform for critical roundtables to meet, including issues pertaining to the ASEAN region through the Southeast Asia Regional Computer Confederation Conference, the 26th conference, which was also held at World Computer Congress, issues pertaining to the young IT practitioners, and we had our annual ACS Young IT Conference all happening at the same time. From the IP3-day perspective, I believe the outcomes, the three outcomes are, it demonstrates to Australia and the rest of the world how critical this issue of professionalism is, not only to ICT, but to the rest of the world, because of the dependency now on ICT in everything we do, whether it's business, government, or transactions. Secondly, I think the IP3-day talked to business, because those who develop computer systems for business need to be as professional and as accountable in their work as one would expect from other professionals, such as doctors, accountants, and lawyers. The technology profession is maturing across the globe. Recently, yesterday, our state branch in South Australia turned 50, so we recognized and celebrated our 50th anniversary of the foundation of the Australian Computer Society State Branch in South Australia. Also this year, the New Zealand Computer Society celebrates 50th in Auckland, a year before the British Computer Society in the United Kingdom. And also this year, with the World Computer Congress, IFIP itself turned 50 since its foundation in Paris with UNESCO. So it shows the maturity of the profession, that we have now come some way down the road towards where doctors, lawyers, and engineers used to be. So the third outcome, I believe, from IP3-day is the importance and the discussion for mutual recognition from our fellow and sister professional associations throughout the world of a standard certification program through IP3 and IFIP.
I guess what we're seeing here is a real coming together, though, you know, especially in Australia, and really the Australian Computer Society being sort of a leader in the world. You mentioned the Young IT program. You also mentioned the Southeast Asian Regional Computer Confederation meeting being held there at the same time. The Seoul Accord, which is a program for accreditation standards and educational programs, being held in Australia. The IP3-day, which is about accreditation of societies and standards for IT professionals, and IP3 standing for the International Professional Practice Partnership Program. And all of this coming under sort of this umbrella of the World Computing Congress and being held and hosted by the Australian Computer Society. So this kind of leads to this whole idea of how is the ACS, that is the Australian Computer Society, leading the world through its programs?
Stephen, as you know, the Australian Computer Society is one of the largest professional body for ICT in the Asian region. In Australia in particular, it's the guardian of ICT professionalism in the Australian sector. Our ACS membership implies a high standard of professional and ethical conduct, integrity, and trustworthiness. And we are very committed to providing our members with the best quality professional development, outstanding networking opportunities, such as what took place in Adelaide yesterday with their 50th anniversary conference, and what has taken place in Brisbane at the end of September with the World Computer Congress. The ACS was also the very first professional association to have its certification program recognized by IP3, and we are very proud of that role we have played in helping to drive and promote ICT professionalism around the world. So the rollout of our ACS certified professional program to our members earlier this year and our certified technologist program this month are steps in our ongoing campaign to promote professionalism in ICT as a global practice. The certification program delivers on many levels and establishes standards for our ICT professionals, and we are looking to establish a specialist program to enable our members to demonstrate their level of knowledge and expertise in specialized areas in 2011. In addition, the ACS has mapped 8 different pathways to the certified professional status. So So regardless of how you start in the ICT industry, the ACS can help you to identify you on that journey and help you to take you to the next step to further your ICT career.
Now, you recently took over the helm of the Australian Computer Society, and you have this very distinguished career. What are your objectives as ACS president?
I took on as president early in January this year, and my election platform for presidency is based on delivering and enhancing the level of professional recognition our members are to receive, and the three key strategies that I've employed and are working through our new strategy plan is the three E's, namely empowerment, engagement, and e-thought leadership. I lead ACS to further engage our key stakeholders by engaging them, whether it's government, community, the industry, in order to ensure that the ACS remains relevant and dynamic on matters that are critical both to the professionals within our sector and to the general community, including ICT skill development, small business enterprises, innovation support, and the use of ICT. In relation to thought leadership, we have worked on a number of programs this year, and one of the key programs we did was the Australian Federal Election Debate forum that we hosted at our Canberra Press Club in August this year, just prior to the federal election. The Australian Computer Society leads this public debate on the impact of technology in society and ran this forum with our leading politicians on a number of technology issues, including the national broadband network. As you're aware, the national broadband and the digital economy plays a big role in today's economic transformation around the world. Recently, our Senator Conroy, who's the Minister for Broadband Communications, delivered with a number of individuals to the United Nations, to Ban Ki-moon, on the digital divide and the important role of broadband and in the national economies and the impact for digital and economic growth. So we look at working with groups around Australia to play a thought leadership role, because we as professionals work in this area of innovation and technology. We have to provide guidance and advice and knowledge transfer of what we're seeing happening in the technology sphere and the impacts on how those technology will have moving forward in our business and community and the role of government. So we take a very active role in that, and certainly we're very pleased with the outcome of that election debate, because the election and the national broadband for the very first time was one of the key differentiators for the political election in Australia. So it has made its way into the mainstream. So as you know, Stephen, it's very rare that technology is a mainstream debate in election around the world. So this year in 2010, the national broadband was one of the key, very key differentiators in getting the current government into power. Also, as my role as president, we are driving the message of professionalism not only through Australia but to the region as well. So, working with the community and the academic sectors to drive the message and the importance of professionalism in the area.
You know, you're playing a critical role as president with the Australian Computer Society, and you're leading so many initiatives within your country but also internationally. But you also have this double role, and it's just amazing, Anthony, that you're able to achieve all of these kind of different initiatives. And that is, you now also preside over the Executive Council of the Southeast Asian Regional Computer Confederation, or CERC. as its president. So what are your objectives there?
Stephen, during the World Computer Congress, I was elected as president for the Southeast Asia Regional Computer Confederation, which comprised a number of our sister professional associations in the Asian region, which include India, Pakistan, Thailand, Taiwan, North Korea, Malaysia, and a number of other countries, including Sri Lanka. So my role as the president, working with my sister societies around that region, is to advance ICT professionalism in that Asian region, working through SIAC. So working collaboratively by our involvement and our relevance to raise the profile of ICT and the ICT sectors to government and the business and communities sector in those countries that I have named. So what I will bring to this role is my experience and background in the Australian sector, with my Australian experience to bring that focus into the region. So I see that's an important role. So also it helps in that I do have an Asian background. So using that skills, that multilingual and multicultural skills to take our Australian achievements and Australian perspective into the Asian region.
You know, sort of a sign of the times, Anthony, in that you're leading these initiatives in so many different areas of the world and very much as a respected, distinguished individual, really an elite professional. Now, what is the role then of professional societies in all of this, and why should professionals themselves get involved?
Well, I think a lot of that is to do with historical history. If you look at lawyers, for instance, couple hundred years, a number of lawyers got together and then they created a society to govern them and to work on standards and professionalism and how they practice this new practice called lawyer or the work of solicitors. So I believe the ICT professional societies are no different. So as we have indicated, ICT is a very new profession, and it's still in its early stages and its early infancy. But I believe now we are maturing, and we are maturing rapidly. And the key role that our professional society should do is to be the guardian of that professionalism in the ICT sector, to ensure that we have high professional standards and membership in the conduct and the execution of our professional duties to assist with the global transformation, the evolution of technology in its enable technology to be used across all walks of life in business, government, and community, including very, very critical infrastructure. So I would definitely encourage all professionals in ICT to get involved, because we are still in its early stages of professionalism. The recognition is coming. Governments now are recognizing the importance of professionalism in ICT because of its critical role in transforming our economic and community and government landscape, not just in Australia, but throughout the world.
So what I'm hearing is that we are at a historical inflection point, and IT professionals and computing professionals out there can actually join their regional or local societies, the professional societies, to get involved to help shape this going forward.
I believe so, Stephen, because as you said, we only turned 50. Most of the other professional groups have been there for a much, much longer period of time. This is an opportunity for people working in the area to come and shape their profession as we move forward. So I think there is a lot of interest, not just in Australia, but globally, and with IP3 and ICIP as well. So most of our businesses are very keen to get involved, at least the people that I've been working with, because they all believe it's a critical and crucial role that ICT has to play.
Okay, so we talked about professional societies and the critical role they play and how professionals themselves can get involved with their professional societies. And you just mentioned an IFIP, which is the International Federation for Information Processing, a UNESCO-sanctioned body affiliated with the United Nations, created about 50 years ago. And we also talked about IP3, this International Professional Practice Partnership Program, which is all about creating a profession of IT. So what role do you see IFIP and IP3 playing regionally and globally?
IP3, supported by IFIP, is leading the development of global IT profession by providing a platform that will help shape and implement relevant policies to foster professionalism in IT worldwide. It is to establish a global partnership and to strengthen the ICT profession and to contribute to developing strong international economies. So IFIP and IP3 have critical roles to play and help by, I believe, defining international standards for professionalism in IT across the globe. Because as we know, IT, ICT, is actually a global enabler. It's one of the things that cross international boundaries. ICT is not limited to any national or geographical boundaries. ICT is an international thing. We have standards. We have standards in programming language, in C, PHP, and many, many other languages and databases. So they are international things. So this is a golden opportunity for us in the global landscape, working with IP3 and IFIP to define and help to shape the way that ICT professionals should and the standards that they should have embraced worldwide. And I believe IP3 will help to create an infrastructure that will encourage and support that development, not just for the practitioners, but the employer organizations, by giving recognition to those who meet and maintain the required standards for knowledge, experience, competency, and integrity. So IFIP and IP3 has a huge role to play moving forward with the sister professional organizations around the world.
So I guess I'll just provide a little bit of context for the audience, and that is the Australian Computer Society, the Canadian Information Processing Society, the Association for Computing Machinery, and the IEEE CS out of the U.S., the British Computer Society, and others around the world and many, many countries. Those are the professional societies within their individual countries, but they belong to a federation called the International Federation of Information Processing, or IFIP. And what happens is that IFIP has this program called IP3, which is about professionalizing the profession, creating a true profession out of IT through standards, through demonstrated professional practice, through a code of ethics, and so on. And that Australia was one of the founders of this IP3 program, which began in 2007. And in fact, as you mentioned, Australia was also the first one to be accredited by this IP3 program as following this global standard. So really quite an accomplishment.
Thank you, Stephen.
In this discussion, you mentioned about IT being sort of this global profession. Can you talk more about what that means, you know, ICT being a true global profession?
With the other more historical, traditional profession that has matured over the years, like lawyers, due to the fact that we have different laws in each national countries, lawyers are trained for specific laws pertaining to that country. So in terms of their mobility and mobility of the skills, there is not much flexibility in terms of movement for lawyers to move around the world. So that itself is a limitation in terms of transference of skills and mobility for practitioners who like to move around to get different experiences in working in different economies. It is quite different, I believe, Stephen, compared for the ICT profession, as for some of the reasons that I've already highlighted too, because the way that ICT came about and the international standards of some of our programming languages and international standards for CIS, for comp- computing device connectivity. We have many of those things. We have many ISO standards, how wireless devices should communicate to computers, how different devices would be able to communicate to different standards. Because of those innovation in the very relatively short time of our IT history, we already have a platform for global sharing and transfer of knowledge and technology. As a result, I think ICT will be the very, very first profession with that opportunity for global recognition and mobility. And going through the IP3 structure with IFIB, it will endanger, it will create a global accreditation process and standards for people working in the IT profession who like to move across national and geographical boundaries. And that will provide huge benefits for transfer of knowledge, skills, and technology, different parts to new other areas.
So let's see if we can translate this in sort of practical terms. Like I'm a member of the Canadian Information Processing Society, and I'm fully certified within the Canadian Information Processing Society, and we've also been accredited by the IP3 program. So I have a designation. I now go to Australia. What does that mean in terms of the designations I have and with the Australian landscape?
I believe, Stephen, if you are certified to a certification standard by the Canadian Society, which is recognized and accredited by IP3, that would be recognized by our Australian Computer Society as conforming to the equivalent standard to our certification program. So that means in terms of recognition, mutual recognition, it means there are less limitations and less restrictions for people from Canada who should wish or who is likely to come and work in the Australian sector. So that would encourage that movement of skills and people between those two countries without a huge bureaucracy in terms of recognition of standards and professional certification.
Well, that really provides a lot of options for, you know, the millions of IT workers worldwide and also the workforce that are in Australia and more. Now, you know, we've talked a lot about sort of this part of Anthony Wong, that is the, you know, the professional society, the Australian Computer Society, the CEARC, which is the Southeast Asian Regional Computer Confederation sort of portion, you know, working with the World Computing Congress and with IFIP and the Seoul Accord and Young IT and so on. And this kind of represents all of these societal contributions that you're making worldwide. But there's also another part of Anthony Wong, and that is an executive of a really vibrant business. Can you talk about some of the value delivered from your business roles?
Sure, Steve. And as I mentioned earlier, in addition to being ICT professional for more than 25 years, I'm also a qualified solicitor and a lawyer who practice in the area of information technology and intellectual property law. And that itself is a relatively new area in the area of law. It comes through the joining of skills and knowledge from the IT sector with the law sector. And it looks at the issues of the use of ICT and how they should be regulated, legislated, and how do we help with disputes in these two named areas of IP, intellectual property and information technology, when they happen in the community and business sectors, in government and in the courts. So I'm spending a lot of time with my clients now who are mainly IT professional, IT businesses, working through some of these complicated issues arising from use of ICT, the licensing of ICT. One of the most, I think, most amazing new areas which is cropping up every day now is the issues of privacy and security through the emergence of what we call now the cloud computing, because technology now is being used across national boundaries. As you know, legislation and legal framework are still stuck in the the national boundary sector. So when we move into the international sector, we have different areas of law from different countries applying. So we have a very complex problem with jurisdiction issues, and that plays itself in its full complexity in this new area that which is much discussed today, which is cloud computing. So for an example, if we have our application hosted in a separate country and something should happen to our transactions or to some incident, the question then arises of which international or which national country laws would apply to that incident. That would be a complex issue in the cloud computing area, because in many circumstances, when we get our services from our suppliers in the cloud, we are not aware of where some of these devices, where some of these services will be served out of. A good example is Facebook. Facebook is not physically hosted in Australia. It's hosted outside Australia. So if there is an issue with Facebook, with Australian residents, government, or even the police for a criminal activity, who should we talk to and what law should apply, because those things are not physically present and operated out of the Australian landscape. So in my work in this area, I deal a lot with some of this highly complex area where the law and the technology converge, which creates very interesting, very new interesting ideas and issues about how to resolve in the area of disputes moving forward. In addition to that, we also have, as I mentioned earlier, the growth in intellectual property, which is an intangible concept. It's not something physical that you can have, like a real estate property or a building or a car or a boat or an aeroplane. Most of our intellectual property created by technology are virtual, or what we call intangible. How do we manage and protect, safeguard, and actually create revenue from those intellectual property assets as we move across our global landscape, where the laws are different in every single country? So that creates a lot of limitations in terms of transfer of intellectual property from one country to another, and they raise issues that we are probably not well equipped today to handle. So those two examples, Stephen, are just some of the issues that I have to deal with day to day. But it's a very exciting area, because it allows me to be very creative, to look at new innovative ways of solving perhaps all problems in the new media, in a new way that we are presented today.
So it sounds like you have an opportunity to create new law, in essence, right?
I would say at some future time, we may have to look at issues of cyber law, which basically governs the whole world in terms of having one set of law for the world rather than different sets of laws for each country. Like broadband, the broadband digital divide is not limited to any particular country. When we use the internet, whether for social networking or for business activities, they go across landscapes. So I would say sometime in the future, there would be huge arguments forward for one single law, or at least some conventional treaties, to govern the way we do electronic commerce and transactions across our international landscape. I mean, we have the law of the sea for shipping and transfer of goods around the world. We have the law of aviation about the airspace. Maybe it's time that we need to look at the law of cyberspace, which is, as we said, cyber as in virtual space. So that will be an interesting proposition, and it would indeed pose great challenges for us as we move forward to manage and put structures in place to manage those areas.
And I take it this would be a topic of discussion, because you are a member of the International Technology Law Association, and you also received a Master's of Law in various forms of technology. So really, you're very well prepared to kind of lead this conversation worldwide.
Certainly, with the International Law Association in IT, every year we host conferences around the world to look at the issues from this immersion area. And a couple of years ago, I was fortunate to participate in a virtual world conference and looking at what sort of law would apply if you go have a life on the, in a virtual space, in a virtual world. So that posed interesting challenges. Does our existing intellectual property law apply in virtual space, in virtual life? I mean, we look at worlds now, like in the movie, The Avatar. When we get into that space, what sort of law would apply in that space, in the virtual reality? So that's an interesting thing. Maybe it will be a science fiction new set of new laws.
I'm just thinking if the audience wants to get in touch with you with regard to your services in this area, they could do a search on Anthony Wong at AGW Consulting. Would that sort of bring up the appropriate links?
Yes, they would indeed. I have many, many contacts online, and very welcome to receive inquiries from readers and listeners around the world. There are quite a few of us around the world today, and we're growing. As a profession, also unique from the IT profession, but now with another multidisciplinary profession. So as we move forward, Stephen, when the ACS look at the next stage of our certification program, the specialist program, we will be looking at some of this multidisciplinary certification program for example, security, to practice in the security space. In addition to some ICT disciplines, what else would you need to make sure that professional in that specialized area have the adequate skills and knowledge to practice in the new area of security specialists? Another area is in the area of health informatics for technologists wanting to work in the area of health delivery, in the use of technology for health care in the health environment. Not just in the administration of database, but actually in the health delivery itself. What extra skill set would that need to have in order to be equipped, to be certified as a professional in this new world we're moving to, where it demands more than one set of professional skills?
You know, just fascinating, and I could see just tremendous amount of queries in this area, and I take it you speak in this area many times and are available worldwide.
Yes, in fact, next week I'm doing a workshop for record management professionals, those people who work in the area of record management, which consists of librarians, IT professionals, information specialists, workers in the fields of maintaining data. So I'm giving a workshop next week about what are the laws pertaining to record retention, business record management, privacy, how to handle privacy inquiries, how long should we retain business records for, and who are we allowed to give it to, in what area and for what purposes. So those are some interesting areas. Working with this record management specialist in this new area of management, more of digital information and digital assets, as opposed from traditional papers.
You know, as a leading international expert in this area, your clients would be very fortunate to have you present the various options and, you know, to give the insights in your workshop. So, you know, in this interview now, we've discussed your societal contribution portion of who Anthony Wong is, and we talked about all the value delivery that you deliver, I should say, through your business roles. Now, what I'd like to do in this last sort of series of questions is kind of mine all of this experience. You are an international expert. You're an acknowledged authority in many, many areas. You have a long history of success. Well, let's see if we can get some sort of real gems that, or nuggets that we can pass on to the audience from all of that experience. So can you kind of share some pivotal lessons from your great and considerable history of national and international success?
Yes, Stephen, I'll just start with one aspect. One of the big questions, big issues coming up, I believe, is the ownership of intellectual property. As we had in the World Computer Congress, we had Richard Stallman speaks about open software and open software foundation. We also have issues of proprietary intellectual property ownership in terms of software and assets pertaining to technology. There is a huge crisis, I believe, coming forward about those ownership questions, because a lot of people working around the world developing software technology devices, we don't pay enough attention to the question of ownership as to who owns it, whether the people who works on it, the individuals, or the companies that employs or commission these people to do the work. So I think in the areas where work are being commissioned or being outsourced for development, there are huge issues arising as to who and to what extent on what portion of those technology applications and developmental effort. Those are some of the challenges that I'm struggling with currently. So I can see them coming through our court systems, coming to the disputes area, and that relates to we need possibly very clear guidelines and understanding about the from the work of our labors and skills more in the intellectual property arena, who owns and how do we manage and protect those intellectual property assets. So these are some of the questions, I believe, for in the next couple of years. So that's one experiences and knowledge like to share what's coming up. I also believe we have issues, Stephen, in the areas of IT governance moving forward, because now a lot of technology applications are being used for many, many things in the world, ranging from community social networking to delivery of services by government to business transactions and in managing trading of physical assets and the share trading. I think we are using technology for many things, but whether now we should allow technology to use for all things, for instance, should we be using technology to trade goods which are important for basic sustenance and basic survival in the world? Should they be traded in a form that they are now disconnected from the realities of how they were produced, how much they were produced for, and the form that they were produced in? So when we start playing with those goods and services, especially food, the reality of the prices for this food, once they get into the manipulation of electronic trading and electronic transactions, do they have any reality based to the original substance which they came from? So I think these are some of the ethical questions, the governance questions about usage of ICT in the world arena that we see today. So this is just one example, and I'm sure there are many, many that my listeners will be able to recognize whether there is an ethical question about whether technology should be used and allowed to be used for everything, or maybe there are certain things where technology should not be used because they are not perhaps sustainable or comparative to human values or ethical values. So these are two of my top realms of reference in terms of my experience. Perhaps a third and last is the leadership area. I think we as a profession, we as ICT professionals need to come up more to the fore today and share our views about how some of this technology could be used to advance our society, to advance our business activities, advance governmental service delivery to citizens. We are the technologists. We know what technology could be used for. We know the ambit of those employment of those new discovery and technology. Those are not necessarily known in the everyday sectors. So I think we have a duty to share that technology so the world can then help us to decide how that should be employed, how that should be used for the advancement of our human race as a species, as well as for all the other beings that we have in the world today, the animals and the insects that we all live with and cohabit with. So I think those are perhaps three of the experiences I've shared, which I have learned through my 25-40 years career in ICT and as a lawyer practicing in technology, intellectual property.
Now, in your prior roles, you must have come across things that were really difficult challenges, and you thought, gee, it's a roadblock that you can't overcome due to circumstances, or it could be the current state of business or technology. Can you describe any sort of challenges like that and what you would do differently now?
In the early stages of my ICT career, we were very involved with processes and documentation and putting in manuals and things in place for systems. Particularly, I worked in one IT project where a lot of emphasis was put on doing those processes, and then we actually forgot that what we're there to do in the first place, which is to deliver systems. So I think in some things I've learned is when we go about doing things alive, there's a balance of things, which is not necessarily the same for everything. So in one particular project, we have to look at that project as a unique project, as to say how much emphasis should I put for different aspects of technology in this particular project, whether we have the adequate for processes to describe the workflow, whether we have spent enough time to describe the specification of systems, whether that meets the needs of our customers, whether we have taken into account the usability of our systems that we create so that users can easily and intuitively use them instead of having to plow and plow through the difficult interface of the systems. I think these are some of the challenges for our ICT professionals working in that area. Lastly, I think costs of systems, developing new systems and implementation, they are huge costs. And our business communities sometimes find it difficult to justify some of those costs. So I think we need to do a better job in selling and be able to quantify some of those costs moving forward. In terms of project management, we hear that many, many projects that we do in IT are not delivered. So the marketplace, in terms of our professionalism, we have to work, I think, using these professional standards. How can we ensure the better delivery and the actual achievements of outcomes for projects that meet the expectations of our customers? I think those are some of those high-level challenges, Stephen.
You know, you've done a lot over your career, and it's a considerable career. So what were some of the key disruptive forces driving change then in your life or in your career, and what can we learn from your experiences?
I think one of the things I learned working in the multinational arena, I worked in a number of multinational companies in my career. One of them was Philips, the Dutch multinational in the IT division, which no longer exists. I also work in Thomson, what is now Thomson Reuters. I was instrumental in this region to start the new digital economy for publishers, to help them change from the paper paradigm of the old world into the new digital arena prior to the emergence of then the internet. What I find my experience working with multinationals are that sometimes the stress for achievement of productivity gains or for material returns are so great that they actually are quite disruptive and detrimental to the health of the organization. I question whether monetary gain is the only way to judge returns of investment, because there are other value systems in addition to money, which are just as important. I think relationship, building sustainable cooperative companies, working with communities, working with government, working across international boundaries, working on things that's sustainable rather than using technology to drive things to achieve gains at all costs to achieve that revenue target. So I think these are some of the disruptive inferences that I've seen in my career in the multinational arena. I was fortunate to be the CIO for the Australian Tourism during the Sydney Olympics, their first CIO, and my job was how to use the new digital media to spread the word of tourism, Australian tourism, around the globe using the new emergence of the internet. So that was a fantastic experience. How do you actually use that to propagate your tourism message around the world? That I find was one of the most delightful challenges and experience I had in using technology for information sharing and branding and global tourism messages for Australia.
Now, if you can put on your sort of crystal ball part of your, you know, forecast the future, I know it's virtually impossible, but, you know, it's rare that we have somebody with your kind of accomplishment, your long history in so many different areas. So let's see if we can make an attempt. Can you provide your predictions of future trends and what you see as their implications and opportunities?
In May this year, I presented to CIBET in Sydney, the CIBET exhibition, CIBET conferences. I talked about the emerging trends of technology, what's some of the coming themes of technology implications and developments in the area. What I'd like to do is to share with the very two simple messages that I left with the audience, in that technology comes and goes. I mean, we have now the iPads, the iPhones, and the many eyes of something devices. But one thing I believe will remain in our landscape, and that will be challenging us every step we go as we evolve using technology. And those two challenges, I believe, are privacy, the privacy issues, and the security issues. So technology comes and goes. We are left with those two big issues. How do we manage the issue of privacy? How do we safeguard our data and protect our intellectual property and information assets? I think those are the two big quickies, the two big questions moving forward to the 21st century.
And then from your many travels, from all the different kinds of roles that you've had and continue to play throughout the world, do you have one or more stories that you can share from your work? Maybe something surprising or unexpected, amazing or humorous?
Probably outside the technology arena. I love to travel, and I travel very extensively in most parts of the world. And one of the fascinating things about I've learned over the years, working with this multinational and our opportunity for traveling, is the diversity of the human race, the human species, the diversity of cultures, of language and thinking, how different cultures see the world in different light, and because of their different settings and their different upbringing, their different religion, no one thing is the same. If two people from two different backgrounds see a same similar facts, they would describe it very differently. And they would describe it based on their cultural experiences, their religion experiences, their background, their education, their training. So we see life with very different, with two different glasses. Some respect with tinted glasses, with different colors. So the way we see life for different people around the world would be quite different. So the message I'd like to give is no one thing is the same from different eyes. People see the world with different eyes. They can see things as to be different through their eyes. So I think we need to have that respect and that ability to know that there's diversity, and we need to respect people for having that diversity.
So really what you're indicating is that one should have tolerance of differences and be inclusive.
Tolerance basically because most of our intolerance is based on ignorance. Ignorance in the way of other people's thinking. I think that's a big fundamental. Because of the different belief systems, we come up with intolerance of other people's belief systems. I agree with you. Yeah, it's that intolerance.
Now we're down to our final question, and you know we had questions about your societal contributions, the impact you're having, the historical significance of that work. We talked about your business roles, and we also talked about mining all of the experiences you have for, you know, some key lessons. Now I'm going to sort of turn the tables and say, you know, if you're doing this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers? So you're going to ask the question, and you're going to provide your own answers.
I think one of the questions as I sit down to prepare for my talk to the World Chinese Economic Forum in a couple of weeks is how technology could be used for that connectivity and that innovation and transformation for the new Silk Road around the world. So Silk Road is just a thing to describe the way people travel in the old days to do commerce and to venture from east to west. I think how we use technology moving forward to do what we do is an interesting, as you, what you say, crystal gazing into the future. We know it's happening. We know it's happening. We don't know exactly how it evolves, but we sort of feel that it would help to improve things for connectivity. But what would that achieve at the end of the day? Connectivity for more deliberations, connectivity for more profits. But I think there is, at the end of the day, a human limitation about how many emails or Twitter or Facebook or communication we have in a day. Like you and me, Stephen, you're talking to me in the early evening now, and I'm in the early morning. So, because technology allows us to communicate around the world, but we do have different time zone and human limitations about needing sleep and all that. So I think if we move forward to a 24/7 world economy, how do we actually function knowing that we can't function 24 hours a day as a human? So I think these are some of the questions I have. I've sort of answered some of those, but I think it's a difficult question. So how do we manage that balance moving forward when there are human limitations in what we can physically do in a single day?
Well, that's an interesting note to end on. And Anthony, you know, it's been a real privilege to have you come in today to do this interview. You are an amazing individual with just an amazing career, and you continue to make these substantive contributions worldwide. So, and we'll continue to follow your significant global and historical initiatives. And again, we're very appreciative of you coming in today to share your time and your wisdom and your insights with our audience. Again, thank you.
Thank you, Stephen, for the interview. I'm very privileged to have this conversation with you, and a very good day from Adelaide, from the South Australian state in Australia, and we're having a beautiful spring summer day today. So I'd like to say thank you for listening to me, and thank you, Stephen, for hosting this conversation.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Anthony Wong, ACS President, CEARC President, CEO, AGW Consulting, past CIO, and a leading top-ranking international lawyer, executive, and authority in business and IT.